Hello, everyone. The title is What is Social Progress? Well, change happens, but how much is progress moving forward? I Googled so-called social progress out of curiosity and shouldn't have been surprised to find a social progress index with a list of countries divided into tiers, with the UK at number 20. Anyway, it's not really what I want to talk about. Over time, there's been immense improvement in living standards. The modest comforts we have would be the envy of past generations. And of course, I'm being parochial, well aware that even in a country that's number two on that list, the same degree of comfort is not universal, and no guarantee that people will not be compelled to turn to a food bank. I want to look at some of the factors which have contributed to the improvements in living standards. Now, this is a 20-minute talk, not a detailed history. So, let's see. I'm going to start with a mention of August Babel. Now, he came to mind recently during a Friday evening talk when it was suggested that individuals might not want to cook in socialism. And you'll see why he came to mind. Well, August Babel was a German social democrat, and in his book, Woman in the Past, Present and Future, and the date is 1879, well, he forecast the demise of a small private kitchen as an obsolescent institution. He had in mind the advanced apparatus to be found at that time in cooking exhibitions and large establishments like hotels. He was looking ahead to a time when living would be arranged on a more communal basis. He said the entire preparation of food will be undertaken by society in the future. But this was many years before kitchens were a common feature in working class homes. Domestic gas ovens had been available since 1855, but were not common until the 1890s. But investigative work by the Fabian Women's Group between 1906 and 13 found that respectable men in full-time work could be struggling to keep a family on about £1 a week because they had inadequate cooking equipment, possibly without an oven or with a gas oven they couldn't afford to use. We go to a 1904 report that was produced in response to concerns highlighted by the difficulty of finding workers fit for the army. In the Boer War, 40% of the volunteers were rejected as being unfit, despite a reduction in the minimum height requirement to 5 feet. That report recommended that every dwelling let for family occupation should be required by law to include a cooking grate, which gives some indication of circumstances at the time. But the concern then wasn't just about getting recruits for the army. Opinions were moving away from the idea that poverty was the result of character weakness. There were the Booth and Roundtree reports, for example. But there was support for welfare and educational measures that would contribute to the efficiency of the workforce. Industrial capitalists needed the state to interfere to equalise conditions between competing enterprises. Trade unions also were seeking more intervention from the state rather than revolution. So there's one or two comments from politicians, from Asquith, the Liberal politician. He said that they had to show that statesmen were competent in redressing evils and solving problems without revolutionary expedients. And then Lloyd George, he said the Labour Party could sweep liberalism away if the government failed to remove the national degradation of slums and widespread poverty. There was also the example of Germany. Germany was overtaken Britain in the industrial field. Bismarck had implemented social insurance measures aimed at undermining support for the SPD. Lloyd George arranged for the opinions of German employers on the Bismarckian insurance schemes to be collected, and he published sections which stressed the economic advantages. The evidence from Germany, which removed the fear that high taxation and welfare schemes would cripple the economy. A cabinet paper from December 1906 said that pensions would mean large savings in the poor law costs. Ideas then were moving towards concerns for improving conditions for workers, but with all sorts of motives. Housing, for example, we'll have a look at, and that's tempered by what was thought appropriate for workers. It wasn't until 1949 that a Housing Act removed the phrase for the working classes, that phrase was dropped in 1949. The earliest municipal housing came towards the end of the 19th century. Otherwise, it had been left to philanthropy. Philanthropy at 5%, which gives you an idea. Peabody buildings were built, but not for the poorest rents. Rents were too high. But the first blocks had no running water in the flats. Council estates were built in the 1930s, for example, in Becontree and Dagenham. And I said I was being parochial because that was where I grew up. Becontree is a very large estate. It was begun by the London County Council in 1921 to reward the families of soldiers who'd served in the First World War. There was a programme of slum clearance between 1931 and 39, and local authorities rehoused four-fifths of the existing slum dwellers. Council estates, for example, in Essex during the 1920s, were for relatively better-off Londoners. Again, the rent was set too high as a deliberate policy. The Becontree and Dagenham estates had gas and electricity, inside toilets and fitted baths, front and rear gardens. The only sink was in the kitchen and there was no running hot water. The washing was boiled in a copper or washed in a sink with the old washboard and mangle. Hot water geysers had been available in the late 19th century, but by 1939, open fires were the main form of heating for more than 90% of homes. Prefabs that were built after the Second World War had well-equipped kitchens, including fridges. And those horribly called affordable homes would not now be built without what are now considered basic amenities. But still, there's a difference to the homes built for the better off. And, of course, there are still people in very poor housing with conditions that are at the least in urgent need of repairs, as well, of course, as people who are homeless. One factor contributing to improved conditions in development is in industry. New industries were replacing the old. And I must mention the national grid. In 1920, there were only 730,000 electricity consumers, but the national grid was completed in the 30s. And by the end of the 30s, there were almost 9 million consumers. By 1939, 2 out of 3 houses were wired for electricity, and the in electricity supply industry employed 325,000 people. There's a wide range of services and consumer goods then. There's cinema, suburban trains, electric domestic appliances like vacuum cleaners, refrigerators, cookers and radios, etc. Broadcasting began in 1926. There's a general development of the engineering industry, which means motor vehicles, aircraft, rearmament from the mid-30s, well, there's progress for you, and the large manufacture of cycles, electrical equipment and consumer durables. The output in 1937 was 60% higher than it had been in 1924. Then you have the motor industry. In 1913, 34,000 vehicles of all kinds, and production increased every year. By the end of the 30s, they were employing 400,000. Mass production, of course, assembly line methods. A 1935 small family car, where the cost was down by half in 1935 from what it had been 10 years earlier. There was growth in the chemical industry, development of plastics, usually in the form of Bakelite, which was used in radios, artificial fibres, including a range of artificial fibres adopted for the clothing industry, for example, rayon. Building construction, that grew at a very high rate, employing 1 million workers. Small companies were merged into larger combines like ICI, EMI and others. They were trading in different countries, but the impetus was to rationalization because of the rise of mass consumer markets. Factories were large, Ford employing 7,000 in Dagenham by 1932, ceased car production there incidentally in 2002. So we come to the 60s and the 70s. Move from heavy industrial base to the new technological industries. And you have Harold Wilson with his white heat of technology. During the 60s, scientists in numbers were appointed to the boards of major companies producing consumer goods. What was known as the systems approach, with planning, research, development, and marketing projects in the most logical and economical fashion. In the chemical industry, there were new plastics and synthetic fibres. The electrical industry having smaller and more efficient refrigerators, washing machines and televisions. There was a dramatic rise in ownership of televisions during the 60s and 70s. By 1971, 91% had a TV. By the late 70s, 71% a washing machine. By 1885, fridge ownership was dropped out of statistics. I should say something, along with the developments in industry, came changes in the kinds of work. Fewer people were employed in manufacturing and more in service industry. Of course, stuff was still being made somewhere. At the beginning of the 20th century, over three quarters of the British labour force is in manual work. By the end of the century, it was down to a third. Position over more recent years is of job insecurity, jobs with 0 hours and part-time, and the effects, of course, of the pandemic on employment. The trade union membership in 1979, 53% of the workforce was in employment was in unions, but by 2000 it was down to 30%. Increasing proportion of union members are teachers, nurses, civil servants. From a low of 6.23 million members in 2016, the numbers have been rising in recent years. And the last figure I have is up to 6.44 million in 2019. The figures have risen for three consecutive years. There was an unprecedented rise in living standards between 1950 and 2000, qualified, of course, because the difference between the population as a whole and conditions for specific groups. There were regional differences and, of course, they were unemployed. Some examples of improvements in the post-World War II period, more than a third of households were without a bath or a shower. By 1991, that was down to fewer than 1%. By 1991, virtually all households had a hot water tap. And by 2007, most homes had central heating. And 95% of washing machine, which I guess also went out of statistics. The rise in living standards after the First World War, well, one factor was the increase in married women working, And to begin with, of course, it provided extra income, but that soon became an integral part of the income, now dependent on two incomes. And I guess a hollow laugh from those who are struggling to manage with three jobs. Before the Second World War, married women generally not working. In the Beveridge report, he said, during marriage, most women will not be gainfully employed. Right, there is a gap. The gap between what is possible and what is generally available has narrowed. But again, it's not universal. Everyone doesn't have a computer. Contributing to the improved living standards, we have developments in technology and mass production techniques, efficiencies of scale in manufacturing and retailing, and the availability of credit. A variety of goods that didn't exist 50 years ago. Some have come and gone, but there's constant innovation, especially in IT communications and things like mobile phones. There's continuous development in digital technology and all kinds of what I'll call gadgets. Wear and tear happens, of course. But the continuous change to what's available in equipment and furniture, when newer and more up-to-date versions appear to so that people can become dissatisfied with what they've got, what has been described as a manufacturer of wants. But of course, technology and fashion are commodities produced for sale and profit. Goods are made of varying qualities to serve different markets, but all on view, feeding expectations and frustrations for those left outside. So we have improved living standards, increased life expectancy, a dazzling array of material possessions and leisure activities. And again, I'm wary of overstating the general experience, but there's the same day-to-day worries, possibly at a more comfortable level. So compared to even 50 years ago, there's progress in living standards. You don't hear politicians here promising improved living standards much now. In some areas, there've been great strides in medicine and dentistry, I have to say. So what has not changed? And don't all shout at once. I always want to quote William Morris, so I'm going to. He said, the workers better treated, better organised, helping to govern themselves, but with no more pretence to equality with the rich. Progress has been made and things look good from a certain perspective, but the reality is different. We're still, in some kind of a dark age. There's the damage to the climate, to the environment, there's wars, and on the other side, mental illness, stress, and violence. Pandemic has shown up the inadequacy of the system in some directions, but also with the numbers of volunteers and the communal efforts, it shows the possibilities for a different approach. Here, I think I'm stopping being parochial. Well-being is not the aim. What I'm saying is that there is a difference between now and, say, 100 years ago, in that conditions have improved. But the relationship between those who own the state and those who don't but do the work remains the same. And here I'm telling you all what you already know, is the private ownership of the means of production. The majority are dependent on wages or state benefits. Times have changed and attitudes to what is acceptable also, but there is still acceptance of inequality and what is considered good enough for different strands of the working class. Inequality is built into the system. The pursuit of profit is still the engine that drives the system, and cost is part of it. And that's why the cladding has not been removed from those tower blocks and why it was put up in the first place. There is no social purpose, so how can there be social progress? Socialism, my friends, is not just a good idea, it is an imperative to change from sale and profit to common ownership, from competition to cooperation, and to production solely for use. Right, there you are.